electrical, magnetic. Before he was done, listeners discovered that indefinable something which had led men to follow him up the bullet-swept hill of San Juan. Jacob Riis joined Roosevelt as the train sped home from the western part of the state during the final night of the canvass. Over a belated midnight supper, they debated the probable size of the impending triumph or defeat. Riis predicted a Roosevelt victory margin of more than 100,000 votes. Roosevelt was less sanguine, believing that if he won, it would be by a mere 10 or 15,000 votes. While they sat together at the table, a knock was heard on the door, and in came the engineer, wiping his oily hands on his blouse, to shake hands and wish him luck. Roosevelt rose, grabbing the engineer's hands with eagerness. "I would rather have you come here," he assured the man, "than have 10 committees of distinguished citizens bring pledges of support." Roosevelt, Riis noted with admiration, was genuinely fond of railroad men, of skilled mechanics of any kind, but especially of the men who harness the iron steed and drive it with a steady eye and hand through the dangers of the night. The engineer's enthusiasm seemed to Riis an omen of victory. When the votes were tallied the following day, Roosevelt's forecast proved more accurate than Riis's projection of sweeping victory. He had been elected governor by a relatively narrow margin of less than 18,000 votes. As Steffens contemplated Roosevelt's successful campaign, he recalled the yardstick set forth by his reform-minded political science professor at Berkeley. "Young gentlemen," he had told the class, "you can get the measure of your country by watching how far Theodore Roosevelt goes in his public career. An honest man trying to work in a dishonest system, Roosevelt would never survive the machine politicians," the professor mournfully predicted. Chapter 9. Governor and Governor General. A foot of snow covered the streets of Albany on January 2, 1899, the day Roosevelt was inaugurated as governor of New York. The thermometer registered several degrees below zero, but the bright sun and jingling sleigh bells lent a jubilant air to the thousands gathered at the State House. "There never was such a mass of people out to see a governor installed," the World reported. In the assembly chamber, where the ceremony would take place, the desks and seats of the members had been removed, and in their places were hundreds of camp chairs for the accommodation of the audience. A deafening outburst of applause greeted Roosevelt as he reached the flag-draped platform. "He stood for a moment in stern-faced dignity," one journalist observed, but the cheers continued. And then, like a sunburst, the familiar Roosevelt smile broke forth. His gaze, drawn to the ladies' gallery where Edith and his 6 children stood, the boys desperately flapping both hands to attract his notice. When he threw his family a kiss, the touch of human nature spurred another round of thunderous applause. Roosevelt's brief inaugural address sketched out the creed he would follow as governor. "He is a party man," the New York Tribune editorial remarked, "one who intends to work with his party and be loyal to it in all things that belong to it." Nevertheless, he made it clear that he would never render to party what belongs to the state, and the state is the first consideration. Addressing fellow reformers who demanded renunciation of Boss Platt and the machine, Roosevelt emphasized that nothing would be accomplished if we do not work through practical methods and with a readiness to face life as it is, and not as we think it ought to be. Yet Mr. Platt would have to accept that, in the long run, he serves his party best who helps to make it instantly responsive to every need of the people. "It was a solemn and impressive ceremony," Edith told her sister Emily, confessing, "I could not look at Theodore or even listen closely, or I should have broken down." That afternoon, she stood by her husband's side to greet more than 5,000 guests attending the festive reception in the executive mansion. As soon as her public duties were fulfilled, however, she escaped to her room, where she could quietly read, write letters, and keep her diary. For this inordinately private woman who seemed physically to cringe in the glare of the public searchlight, The prospect of life in Albany was intimidating. Reporters had already intrusively chronicled every aspect of the general exodus that carried Mrs. Roosevelt, Miss Roosevelt, and the five little Roosevelts, the governesses, the nurses, the maid, and the coachman, the mongrel but gentlemanly dog Susan, a new French bulldog, El Carney, the warhorse Texas, and the other horses and the pony, as well as the guinea pigs, from Oyster Bay to the governor's three-story mansion. Fanny Smith, who visited her old friend soon after her arrival, noted that Edith, usually an extremely calm and self-controlled person, paced nervously up and down the room. Faced with the imposing task of transforming the cavernous governor's mansion into a comfortable family home, Edith was understandably anxious. After securing the admittance of 12-year-old Theodore Jr. and 10-year-old Kermit to a local boys' academy, she established a schoolroom in the basement for the younger children, Ethel and Archie. A nursery was created for little Quentin, a governess hired for 15-year-old Alice, and a third-floor billiard room remodeled to become a gymnasium. A competent staff orchestrated drawing-room receptions, musical entertainments, and large dinner parties, but Edith remained ill at ease on such elaborate occasions. She much preferred the sort of dinner parties and literary discussions she had once enjoyed with her intimate Washington circle. "If only I could wake up in your library," she told Cabot Lodge, "how happy I would be." Edith soon began to adjust to her new role, however, just as she had settled into her new home. "Edith will never enjoy anywhere socially as much as she enjoyed Washington, nor make friends whom she cares for as much as she did for you and a few others," Roosevelt confided to Maria Storer. "But she enjoys the position here greatly, and has made some very good friends, and is altogether having an excellent time. She is picking up in health, and is looking very pretty." In February, a candid photograph of Edith appeared in newspapers. The image reveals a slender woman of medium height, dressed in plain but perfect taste. Although she had steadfastly refused interviews and declined to furnish a photograph for publication, reporters considered her neither haughty nor excessively modest. She simply disliked personal publicity, and proved as intractable as her husband once her mind is made up. Despite her habitual reticence, she never made reporters feel unwelcome in her home. Her family life was simply not an appropriate subject for their stories. "Everything about her speaks of grace," an Iowan journalist remarked. "There's honor even among reporters, or at least there's gratitude," another explained. "We knew Mrs. Roosevelt's wish to keep herself and the children out of the papers, and after her courtesy to us, we were glad to respect that wish." She was always prepared, however, to entertain reporters and friends with humorous stories about the new governor. In a special scrapbook, she meticulously assembled every caricature relating to her husband, whether they represented him as riding a hobby horse or dispensing peanuts in paper bags from a corner stand. While other wives were known to burn papers and magazines that burlesqued their husbands, Edith had perfect confidence in Theodore's good humor and relished the laughter they shared over the cartoons. Newspaper readers soon learned that Theodore Roosevelt was unlike any governor New York had known. He arrived in his office long before the usual hour of 9 o'clock to begin the baffling task of sorting through his mail. 300 or 400 letters arrived each morning, a far larger volume than any previous governor had contended with. At 10 a.m., his official day commenced with an hour reserved for assemblymen and senators, followed by rapid-fire meetings with political delegations, members of his administration, and individual petitioners. Roosevelt was ever on his feet during these sessions, ranging restlessly as he talked, laughed, or scowled. He punctuated sentences with his fists, filling the entire room with his presence. The stately desk, where his staid predecessors had judicially received visitors, might as well have been removed, one observer noted, for it hardly knows the governor. Despite Roosevelt's often combustible and seemingly impulsive nature, he maintained a schedule so precise that he could reliably meet an individual slated for 12:20 to 12:25 and conclude business just in time to usher in his 12:25 appointment. Visitors were encouraged to plunge at once into their subject, for the governor deftly, yet positively, closed the interview after the allotted time. Roosevelt's official day ended at 5 p.m., though he frequently remained in his office until 7 o'clock. Once the governor departed the Capitol for the short walk to the Executive Mansion, however, he was not to be disturbed unless by an emergency. "These evening hours," wrote a correspondent who profiled the governor, "are set apart for his literary work, his reading and social converse with his family, the Roosevelt youngsters having a decided claim, even in the midst of the most pressing affairs of state." Honoring his promise to regularly consult organization leaders, Roosevelt soon announced that he would visit New York City every weekend during the legislative session to meet with Boss Platt and Benjamin O'Dell, chairman of the Republican State Committee, an announcement that incensed staunch reformers. The Evening Post, an influential independent paper that had supported Roosevelt's bitter fight against Tammany Hall as police commissioner, now decried his willingness to touch Platt both politically and socially. "Never had a governor so belittled the dignity of the office," opined the Albany Argus. Imagine for a moment William Seward, Samuel Tilden, or Grover Cleveland running down to New York, like a Capital District messenger boy, to bring back the orders of some party boss. While Roosevelt absorbed attacks from Democratic papers with equanimity, he could barely contain his fury at the irrational independents and the malignant make-believe independents, who remained aloof, never engaging genuine political issues for fear of sullying themselves. "These solemn reformers of the tomfool variety," Roosevelt complained, stridently assumed that any contact with the bosses indicated some sinister collusion. "I have met many politicians whom I distrust and dislike," Roosevelt told a friend, "yet there are none whom I regard as morally worse than the editors of the Post." His indignation was aggravated by a conviction that the Post's denunciation might cause some of his friends, the sincere reformers as opposed to the lunatic fringe, to misconstrue his actions. Once again, Roosevelt reached out to Steffens, proffering what the reporter termed an understanding. Steffens would meet the governor each Friday afternoon when he arrived in Manhattan for his weekly consultation with the bosses, keeping in close touch with him all the time he was there, and escorting him to the train station for his return to Albany on Sunday evening. "I was to know all the political acts he was contemplating, with his reasons for them," Steffens recounted. By sharing the full context of each decision and appointment before it became public, Roosevelt trusted that Steffens would credit and document the complex, pragmatic maneuvering behind an ethical and effective approach to leadership. Roosevelt's trust was well placed. Steffens kept the governor's confidences until he determined a course of action, providing an authoritative account of the decision-making process for the commercial advertiser. "T.R. was a very practical politician," Steffens recalled, "and it was partly from watching him sympathetically that I lost some of my contempt for politicians and practical men generally." Steffens was not the sole journalist to whom Roosevelt granted such inside access. The governor understood that however courteously he might handle Platt and the organization, he would inevitably clash with them on a range of salient issues. When the battles began, he would need the persuasive power of the press to marshal public sentiment for his reformist agenda. Only by appealing directly to the people, by going over the heads of party leaders, did he have any chance of pushing significant reform through the legislature. To that end, Roosevelt soon declared that he would hold two press conferences each day he was in town. His unprecedented announcement thrilled the 25 State House correspondents, who quickly labeled the morning session the séance and the afternoon session the pink tea. The governor generally opened these informal conferences with a smile and nearly always with a joke, generally at his own expense. In the course of 15 minutes, one reporter marveled, he would explain his objectives and the rationale behind them. He outlined his future movements and intentions regarding various controversial issues, clearly indicating which statements were on the record and which were simply shared confidences not meant for publication. These lively forums impressed the journalists with the wonderful mental activity of the man. With his marvelous fund of general information to draw upon, Roosevelt never haltingly answered or appeared at a loss. One of Roosevelt's first acts as governor was to convene a meeting with Jacob Riis and three leading trade unionists to determine the most constructive labor legislation to sponsor. The labor leaders agreed that while some new laws were in order, workers would most benefit from the application of laws that already had been enacted to cover maximum hours of work, sweatshop conditions, prevailing wages, and safety requirements. In too many instances, such laws had been put on the books simply to satisfy public demand. As soon as publicity and interest faded, they became dead letters, and companies did as they pleased. To dramatize these flagrant violations, Roosevelt requested that Riis accompany him on a series of surprise visits to tenement sweatshops, ostensibly under the supervision of state inspectors. "I think that perhaps if I looked through the sweatshops myself," Roosevelt told Riis, "we might be in a condition to put things on a new basis, just as they were put on a new basis in the police department after you and I began our midnight tours." Riis never forgot the appalling conditions they unearthed during their inspection tour. "It was on one of the hottest days of early summer," he recalled. "I had picked 20 5-story tenements, and we went through them from cellar to roof, examining every room and the people we found there. In building after building, the minimum requirements for licensing home work, no bed in the room where the work was done, no outsider employed, no contagious disease, and only one family living in the rooms, were found wanting or neglected entirely." As soon as the tour concluded, Roosevelt proceeded to the factory inspector's office. "I do not think you quite understand what I mean by enforcing a law," he admonished, insisting that the inspectors make owners of the tenements understand that old, badly built, uncleanly houses shall not be used for manufacturing in any shape. Day's end found Riis spent, but Roosevelt percolating with new ideas and eager for extended discussion over a good meal. Immediately he would increase the number of tenement inspectors, and when the legislature convened the following winter, he would successfully introduce a bill to revise the code of tenement house laws. Years later, Roosevelt recalled his labor record as governor with satisfaction. Although his effort to pass an Employers' Liability Act failed, he did manage to obtain the grudging and querulous assent of the bosses for legislation establishing an 8-hour day for state employees, limiting the maximum hours women and children could work in private industry, improving working conditions for children, hiring more factory inspectors, and mandating air brakes on freight trains. At a time when laissez-faire attitudes reigned, even such limited measures represented considerable progress. Roosevelt also took pride in a remarkably innovative conservation record. Within weeks of taking office, he invited an old friend, the architect Grant LaFarge, along with the head of the United States Forestry Division, Gifford Pinchot, to spend the night at the governor's mansion. Pinchot, like Roosevelt, had been born into a moneyed New York mercantile family, but had chosen to dedicate his life to public service. A devoted naturalist and wilderness enthusiast, he had studied forestry conservation in France after graduating from Phillips Exeter Academy and Yale College. The tall, confident 33-year-old brought great originality and ambition to his position when McKinley appointed him to head the Forestry Division. Pinchot's visit with Roosevelt was unforgettable from the outset. "We arrived just as the executive mansion was under ferocious attack from a band of invisible Indians," he wrote in his autobiography, "and the governor of the Empire State was helping a household of children to escape by lowering them out of a second-story window on a rope." After rescuing his young pioneers, Roosevelt settled down to a long evening of food, drink, and conversation, punctuated by a spirited boxing match in which Pinchot had the honor of knocking the future president of the United States off his very solid pins, though the governor emerged victorious from the wrestling contest that concluded their visit. The alliance established that night would play a central role in future conservation policy. In the months that followed, Roosevelt convinced the state legislature to preserve tens of thousands of forested acres in the Catskills and the Adirondacks. He appointed a single superintendent to replace the 5-man Fisheries, Game, and Forest Commission, which had become a haven for machine spoilsmen. He created the Palisades Park and used his bully pulpit to promote awareness of the state's unique natural resources and the pressing need to conserve them. Roosevelt's second annual message, historian Douglas Brinkley argues, was the most important speech about conservation ever delivered by a serious American politician up to that time. Pinchot committed whole passages to memory, as if it were the Gettysburg Address, while ornithologists considered its call for the protection of endangered birds the tipping point for the Audubon movement. "I hardly need say how heartily I sympathize with the purposes of the Audubon Society," Roosevelt maintained, expressing his profound emotional investment in the matter. "When the bluebirds were so nearly destroyed by the severe winter a few seasons ago, the loss was like the loss of an old friend, or at least like the burning down of a familiar and dearly loved house. But when I hear of the destruction of a species, I feel just as if all the works of some great writer had perished, as if we had lost all instead of only part of Polybius or Livy." This lifelong sympathy proved instrumental in preserving natural lands and wildlife habitat in his state, and would become a driving force to protect the entire nation's wilderness. The governor was initially surprised that on many issues, even those involving labor and conservation, he got on fairly well with the machine. Indeed, his endeavors to placate Platt through weekly pilgrimages to the city seemed so successful that he was unprepared for the storm of protest when he came out in favor of a new franchise tax on corporations. Until this moment, Roosevelt acknowledged, he had only imperfectly understood the intricate web linking the Platt machine to the corporate world. Unlike other political bosses, Senator Platt did not use his political position to advance his private fortunes. He lived simply and had few interests beyond the powerful network he had meticulously constructed and nurtured over the decades. To keep control of the political organization, however, he required regular revenue from the corporate world in the guise of contributions for campaign purposes and donations for the good of the party. These sums were distributed to his select candidates for the state legislature, with the gentleman's understanding that they could be counted upon for important votes, particularly when an issue touched upon the corporations that fueled the machine. The public had small awareness and less understanding of this threat that Roosevelt labeled the Invisible Empire. For decades, the state of New York had granted exclusive franchises to corporations to operate immensely lucrative electric street railways, telephone networks, and telegraph lines. These franchises, often secured by outright bribery, had been awarded with no attempt to obtain tax revenues from the corporations in return. After investigating the issue, Roosevelt concluded that it was a matter of plain decency for these corporations to pay their share of taxes for privileges worth tens or even hundreds of millions. In fact, a bill to tax such franchises had previously been introduced by John Ford, a Democratic state senator from New York City. The measure had been suffered to slumber undisturbed in the machine-dominated assembly until the governor's surprise announcement brought the issue into sudden prominence. At their next breakfast meeting, Platt furiously warned Roosevelt that the Ford bill would never be permitted to pass. If he persisted in pushing it forward, the governor risked an open break with the machine. "This radical legislation," Platt argued, "had no serious public support until you sprang forward as its champion." In its stead, Platt suggested that a joint legislative committee consider the whole question of taxation, with the obligation to report back the following year. Realizing that the tax bill had dim prospects for success without Platt's support, Roosevelt agreed to postpone consideration until the commission issued its report. Reformers recognized the commission as a cynical effort to kill the bill, and roundly derided Roosevelt for bending to the subterfuge of the machine. "The time to tax franchises is now, not next year," goaded the Tribune. "Roosevelt stops franchise tax," the Herald blared. Stung by the swarm of criticism from reformers, Roosevelt altered his approach, explaining to reporters that despite his reservations about the Ford bill, he would like to see it become law, cognizant of the blackmailing power Tammany Hall would gain, he was particularly concerned by the provision allowing cities to determine tax assessments instead of the state. Nevertheless, a flawed bill was better than none, and Roosevelt concluded that if he could get a show in the legislature, the bill would pass, because the people had become interested, and the representatives would scarcely dare to vote the wrong way. Through a complicated series of maneuvers, the bill was finally brought to a vote in both chambers just before the legislative session ended. While many Republicans in the lower chamber heeded Platt's directive to vote against the measure, Roosevelt secured enough Republican support that, combined with a heavy Democratic vote, he was able to produce a majority. It was said today, Steffens declared in the Commercial Advertiser, that many of the men who supported the measure have been threatened with political destruction by the party leaders for their action in the matter. These men may rest assured, Steffens knowingly asserted, that they will have the sympathy and support of the governor for their courage in openly declaring themselves. He appreciates courage. Asked how the tax would affect his company, the counsel for one affected corporation was blunt. "Right in the solar plexus," he replied. In the days that followed, the stock market suffered a significant drop. "You will make the mistake of your life if you allow that bill to become law," Platt warned Roosevelt at the close of a bitter letter. He promised the governor that an ugly confrontation was imminent unless Roosevelt summoned that very rare and difficult quality of moral courage not to sign the bill after endeavoring to pass it. "When the subject of your nomination was under consideration, there was one matter that gave me real anxiety," Platt wrote. "I had heard from a good many sources that you were a little loose on the relations of capital and labor, on trusts and combinations, and, indeed, on those numerous questions which have arisen in politics affecting the security of earnings and the right of a man to run his own business in his own way, with due respect, of course, to the Ten Commandments and the Penal Code. Or, to get at it even more clearly, I understood from a number of businessmen, and among them many of your own personal friends, that you entertained various altruistic ideas." In Platt's lexicon, Roosevelt clearly understood altruistic meant communistic or socialistic. The governor, Platt acknowledged, had lately adjourned a legislative session that created good opinion throughout the state. "Then, at the last minute, and to my very great surprise, you did a thing which has caused the business community of New York to wonder how far the notions of populism, as laid down in Kansas and Nebraska, have taken hold upon the Republican Party of the state of New York. I do not believe that it is wise or safe for us as a party to take refuge in mere negation and to say that there are no evils to be corrected," Roosevelt countered. "It seems to me that our attitude should be one of correcting the evils and thereby showing that, whereas the populists, socialists, and others really do not correct the evils at all, or else only do so at the expense of producing others in aggravated form, that we Republicans hold the just balance and set our faces as resolutely against improper corporate influence on the one hand as against demagogy and mob rule on the other." Their disagreement on this salient issue troubled him, he confessed to Platt, "especially since you have treated me so well and shown such entire willingness to meet me halfway." Nevertheless, he firmly believed that the Republican Party should be beaten, and badly beaten, if we took the attitude of saying that corporations should not, when they receive great benefits and make a great deal of money, pay their share of the public burdens. Corporate representatives descended on Roosevelt, warning that if he signed the bill, under no circumstances could he ever again be nominated for any public office, as no corporation would subscribe to a campaign fund if he was on the ticket. Refusing to be bullied, yet well aware that a break with the organization would be fatal, Roosevelt made one concession. Before signing the bill, he told Platt, he would call a special legislative session and tried to pass an amendment that would substitute a state board of assessors for local authorities. He also agreed to hold a hearing with corporate representatives and solicit suggestions for additional improvements in the bill. In the event the extra session produced amendments that would weaken the tax, however, he would simply sign the Ford bill in its present form. Some of the morning newspapers repeat the expression of astonishment that Governor Roosevelt has consulted the attorneys of corporations, Steffens reported in the Commercial Advertiser. Some yellow minds cannot seem to understand that the governor is willing to fight the corporations to make them do right and yet be ready to negotiate just terms of peace, nay, to fight for the corporations against wrong. In fact, when Roosevelt learned that corporations in some communities had already paid local taxes, he agreed to an amendment providing that any taxes already payable for public rights could be deducted from the franchise valuation. The passage of this amendment, along with the shift in state assessors, allowed Platt to make the best of a difficult situation when Roosevelt signed the bill. Persistent efforts have been made by the Democratic newspapers, the boss told reporters, to have it appear that there are serious divisions in the Republican Party. Such claims he blithely dismissed. All agreed, he now maintained, that franchises were a proper and necessary subject of taxation. While the original bill had been carelessly drawn and thoughtlessly enacted, these just and reasonable amendments enabled Platt and his organization to save face and support the bill. Passage of the amended franchise tax bill is a distinct personal triumph for Governor Roosevelt, the Commercial Advertiser wrote in its lead editorial. By exercise of tact and by concessions where no sacrifice of principle was involved, the governor achieved his ends. His integrity of motive and his eagerness to prevent party rupture were so apparent that Republican legislators were left with no choice but to support him. In the summer of 1899, following his successful push for the franchise tax, Roosevelt prepared to head west to New Mexico for the first reunion of his beloved Rough Riders. "Would you let me ask a great favor?" he wrote William Allen White several weeks before the trip, "and that is that you should try to join me on the train and ride 3 or 4 hours with me. There is very much that I have to talk over with you. As you know, you have got the ideas of Americanism after which I am striving." White and Roosevelt had met 2 years earlier during the reporter's first journey to the East Coast at the invitation of Sam McClure. Before proceeding to New York, White spent a few days in the nation's capital, where he was informed that a young fellow named Roosevelt in the Navy Department had read his famous editorial and book of short stories about Kansas and was eager to meet him. White was deeply impressed by his first glimpse of the man who would become a close friend, confidant, and correspondent. A tallish yet stockily built man, physically hard and rugged, obviously fighting down the young moon crescent of his vest, quick-speaking, forthright, a dynamo of energy, given to gestures and grimaces, letting his voice run its full gamut from bass to falsetto. Roosevelt seemed, White's description concluded, to be dancing in the exuberance of a deep physical joy of life. "We walked from the Navy Department under the shade of the young trees that lined the streets that summer day to the Army and Navy Club, had lunch, talked and talked, and still kept talking," White recollected. Roosevelt was just then beginning to comprehend the yearnings of America's working poor for social and economic justice, to see clearly that our problems were no longer problems of production, but problems affecting the distribution of wealth and income. For White, still adhering to conservative predilections, Roosevelt's progressive ideas were a revelation. "He sounded in my heart the first trumpet call of the new time that was to be," White recalled, stressing that such notes represented youth and the new order, and the passing of the old into the new. The young journalist was overcome by the splendor of Roosevelt's personality. "I had never known such a man as he," White wrote more than a quarter century later after Roosevelt's death, "and never shall again." Roosevelt also felt an immediate kinship with the ebullient writer. Both men were blessed with confidence and energy, both ready to engage in the political and ideological contests that would define their country. While the rotund White had no interest in the physical challenges and trials that Roosevelt adored, preferring to spend his leisure time reading poetry or playing piano. His nimble, perceptive mind perfectly matched Roosevelt's, and they shared a vigorous style of speaking and writing. Doubtless, Roosevelt also recognized that the celebrated country journalist was an influential leader of middle-class opinion. Between his newspaper editorials, magazine articles, and a growing list of books, one historian suggests, White could claim one of the largest audiences of any writer in America at the turn of the century. Following their initial encounter, the two men had continued to exchange letters, articles, and books. Roosevelt purchased an out-of-town subscription to the Emporia Gazette and sent his new friend a copy of his recently published volume, American Ideals and Other Essays. "I read it with feelings of mingled astonishment and trepidation," White recalled, confessing that "it shook my foundations, for it questioned things as they are. It challenged a complacent plutocracy." By the time Roosevelt's train steamed through Kansas en route to New Mexico that summer of 1899, White was working with the zeal of a converted disciple to help his friend become president in 1904, assuming that McKinley would run again in 1900. Paul Morton, vice president of the Santa Fe Railroad, had offered Roosevelt his private car so the governor and his invited guests, including White and H.H. Kohlsatt, publisher of the Chicago Times-Herald, could relax and talk. On short notice, White had done his utmost to ensure that reporters and enthusiastic supporters greeted Roosevelt's train at every stop. In Topeka, 3,000 people gave the New York governor a rousing reception. At Newton Station, cannon boomed, whistles were blown, and the crowd cheered. In Kansas City, men wore cards in their hatbands promoting Roosevelt in 1904. The largest audience gathered in White's hometown of Emporia. "No public man who has come into Kansas during these last 10 years has stirred as much personal enthusiasm as Roosevelt," White's Emporia Gazette proclaimed. Roosevelt made a short fighting speech that roused supporters. "Governor Roosevelt may be said to be an Eastern man with a Western temperament," the Kansas City Star noted. "His sympathy with the people of the Trans-Mississippi Country and the power he has displayed in appealing to their fancy marks him as a person of unusual breadth." Despite a mere 48 hours' notice of his arrival, White rhapsodized, "Roosevelt had a larger crowd at the Kansas stations than McKinley had with the State Central Committee back of him. Reporters with both trains concede this. There is no man in America today whose personality is rooted deeper in the hearts of the people than Theodore Roosevelt." Kohlsatt, who had never met Roosevelt before, was stunned by the fervor of the crowds. On travels with his close friend McKinley, he had witnessed nothing comparable to the New York governor's reception. The night the train left Emporia, he and Roosevelt stayed up talking until midnight. Roosevelt was curious to learn about Kohlsatt's relationship with McKinley. "For 7 years," Kohlsatt proudly noted, "McKinley did not give one speech to the nation without either wiring, telephoning, or writing me, and sending me his speeches to read before delivering them." When Kohlsatt the next day begged pardon for having sounded arrogant, Roosevelt put his mind at ease. "Do you know what I thought after I went to bed?" Roosevelt asked. "I wondered if you would do the same thing for me." Delighted to find that Roosevelt welcomed his advice, Kohlsatt suggested that he issue a pledge of support for McKinley's renomination. McKinley's friends, he had learned, were irritated by premature talk of Roosevelt's presidential ambitions. Recognizing the value of Kohlsatt's counsel, Roosevelt immediately telegraphed the president, telling of the sentiment he had found in the West for his renomination, and provided a similar statement to the press for publication. Shortly afterward, Roosevelt received a telegram from President McKinley inviting him to the White House. "Oh, mentor," Roosevelt addressed Kohlsatt, "was my McKinley interview all right? Didn't we have a good week together?" Roosevelt wrote a warm letter to White as well, expressing deep gratitude for their trip together. His absolute trust in White allowed him to unguardedly share his hopes and intentions. "Even in that summer of 1899," White recalled, "we were planning for 1904. Before they parted, White promised to send Roosevelt a map analyzing the strengths of various factions in each Western state, helping to determine which political leaders should be approached, and by whom. Meanwhile, he assured the governor that the trip through Kansas was already bearing great fruit, as evidenced by laudatory clippings from the Kansas newspapers that White enclosed. He recommended that Roosevelt send a personal note to each editor and publisher he met along the way. "All of these men have endorsed you emphatically since your departure, and spoke of you not only as possibility, but as probability for 1904. White assured him, adding that a personal acknowledgement would convince those men of their wisdom. Increasingly, White began to identify the trajectory of Roosevelt's success with nothing less than the nation's prospects. "When the war with Spain broke out, I wanted to go the worst kind," White confided to Roosevelt. "But my wife was sick, and I felt that my first duty was to her. Then, when your regiment had such remarkable success, and when you came home and were made governor and acquitted yourself so admirably, I formed a great desire to help you to be president of the United States. It has seemed to me that if I could perform some service for you that would land you in the presidency, I would perform as great a service for my country as I could perform upon the battlefield." In the years that followed, the two men exchanged more than 300 letters. White reacted to Roosevelt's speeches, and Roosevelt religiously read White's stories and articles as they appeared. "I think The Man on Horseback almost your strongest bit of work," he wrote, in response to White's tale of an honest man corrupted by wealth as he builds a street railway empire, and in the process loses his idealistic son. "There is a certain iron grimness about the tragedy with its mixture of the sordid and the sublime that made a very deep impression on me," Roosevelt told his friend. After finishing another of White's stories about a populist senator who hammers away at trusts and money power while building his own fortune through shady deals, Roosevelt penned a 2,000-word reply. "You are among the men whose good opinion I crave and desire to earn by my actions," he frankly avowed. "I rank you with, for instance, Judge Taft of Cincinnati and Jim Garfield of Cleveland, and with the men whom I am trying to get around me here, men of high ideals who strive to achieve these ideals in practical ways, men who want to count for decency and not merely to prattle." Roosevelt was particularly intrigued by White's views on the problem of the trusts, finding himself in a great quandary what position to advocate about them. His struggle for the franchise tax had sensitized him to the growth of popular unrest and popular distrust over the increasing concentration of power in large corporations. He told Lodge he was surprised to find that many working men who had supported McKinley and the Republicans in 1896 now insisted that Bryan was the only man who can control the trusts, and that the trusts are crushing the life out of the small men. He feared that so long as Republicans failed to develop a cogent policy regarding trusts, those workers who suffered a good deal of misery would gravitate toward the quack, whose dangerous remedies would undo the benefits of the Industrial Revolution. In the months that followed, Roosevelt consulted a variety of experts to develop a reasonable proposal for regulating the trusts, which he intended to present in his second annual message to the legislature when it reconvened in January. When a draft of the message was completed, he sent it to his old friend Elihu Root, a successful corporate lawyer who had just joined McKinley's cabinet as war secretary. Root's vehement opposition to the franchise tax measure had strained their friendship for a time, but he was such a good fellow, Roosevelt told Lodge, that I was sure it would not last, and now I think every shade of it has vanished. Root read the draft carefully, making a number of changes to tone down Roosevelt's rhetoric and moderate his condemnation of those who amassed their riches by means which are utterly inconsistent with the highest rules of morality. Roosevelt gratefully accepted most of Root's suggestions. "Oh, Lord, I wish there were more of you," he wrote. "You have the ideas to work out, whereas I have to try to work out what I get from you and men like you." The lengthy message, delivered on January 3, 1900, opened with praise for the legislative achievements in the previous year, taking special note of the passage of the franchise tax law. More remained to be done, however, to address the state's industrial problems. In our great cities, there is plainly in evidence much wealth contrasted with much poverty. And some of the wealth has been acquired or is used in a manner for which there is no moral justification, he said. Then, taking heed of Root's advice, he carefully qualified this indictment, noting that wealth which is expended in multiplying and elaborating real comforts, or even in pleasures which produce enjoyment at all proportionate to their cost, will never excite serious indignation. We do not wish to discourage enterprise, Roosevelt stressed. We do not desire to destroy corporations. We do desire to put them fully at the service of the state and the people. He acknowledged that antitrust legislation, vengefully designed to punish the mere acquisition of wealth, would be destructive, but insisted that it would be worse than idle to deny the existence of abuses of a very grave character. Consequently, we must set about finding out what the real abuses are, with their causes, and to what extent remedies can be applied. The first essential, Roosevelt maintained, is knowledge of the facts, publicity. Such exposure would open the trusts to investigation for misrepresentation or concealment regarding material facts, and reveal a corporation's involvement in unscrupulous promotion, overcapitalization, unfair competition, resulting in the crushing out of competitors, or the raising of prices above fair competitive rates. He recognized that care should be taken not to stifle enterprise or disclose any facts of a business that are essentially private, but insisted on the state's right to protect the public from monopoly, and even from the colossal waste of resources in vulgar forms of social advertisement. With the facts in hand, measures, including taxation, could be devised to regulate the trusts. Most immediately, Roosevelt reiterated, publicity is the one sure and adequate remedy which we can now invoke. Advocating the adoption of what is reasonable in the demands of reformers as the surest way to prevent the adoption of what is unreasonable, Roosevelt hoped to propel the party of property toward a more enlightened conservatism. The bosses had no interest in Roosevelt's musings about a transformed Republican Party. On the contrary, Platt and O'Dell considered the message, even with Root's modifications, dangerously provocative toward business. O'Dell warned that Roosevelt's call to increase publicity surrounding corporate activities would spur manufacturers to leave New York State. Tensions with the party bosses escalated further when the governor threw his support behind a bill that would compel corporations to disclose information on their structure and finance. To Roosevelt's great disappointment, the public did not rally behind the bill. The danger of the trusts, apparent to farmers and wage earners, had not yet penetrated the consciousness of middle-class America. In 3 years' time, Ida Tarbell and her fellow muckrakers would reach that important audience through their narrative abilities, putting faces and names to the giant corporations, shining a bright light on the sordid maneuvers that were crushing independent businessmen in one sector after another, dramatizing the danger in a way the voting population could no longer ignore. In 1900, however, the trusts remained amorphous entities, arousing vague apprehension but insufficient outrage to exert pressure on the political machines operating as their protectors. And in the absence of public demand, it was not difficult for Platt to prevent the legislature from acting on Roosevelt's proposal. Dissension between Platt and Roosevelt continued to intensify. The 3-year term of the state superintendent of insurance was coming to a close in February 1900. Lou Payne, the current superintendent, was Platt's right-hand man. His reappointment was a foregone conclusion. Reading newspaper reports of Payne's cozy relationships with the very companies he was supposed to oversee, Roosevelt issued an announcement that he would seek a new superintendent. Straight away, the party countered with a statement that Payne would continue at his post, no matter what the opposition to him may try to do. At a contentious breakfast, Platt issued an ultimatum to the governor, warning, that if he chose to fight, he would most certainly lose, for under the New York Constitution, the assent of the Senate was necessary not only to appoint a man to office, but to remove him from office. There was no need to remind Roosevelt who controlled the Senate. "I persistently refused to lose my temper," Roosevelt recalled. "I merely explained, good-humoredly, that I had made up my mind." Though he steadfastly refused to consider Payne's reappointment, Roosevelt moved to conciliate the organization. At the next breakfast meeting, he gave Platt a list of good machine men and told him to select any name on it. Still, Platt refused to compromise. While independent newspapers endorsed Roosevelt's decision to remove Payne, they criticized his attempt to mollify Platt. "Why does he not fight in the open?" the Evening Post queried. He could openly say that he found a rogue in office whom all the powers of political corruption in both parties were banded together to keep there, and that he, the people's governor, must appeal to the good citizens to sustain him in his fight against the whole Confederate crew. That would be real war, and how the people would volunteer for it. That would be raising a standard to which honest men could repair. But what sort of banner is it, on which the chief insignia are muffins and coffee, devoured by Roosevelt and Platt, sitting cheek by jowl? The impasse persisted, until Roosevelt, with the help of a newspaper investigation, uncovered a loan of more than $400,000 that Payne had received from a trust company controlled by an insurance firm under the superintendent's jurisdiction. Unwilling to risk a scandal and extended scrutiny, Platt finally capitulated. He agreed to the nomination of Francis Hendricks, one of the men on Roosevelt's list, whom the governor considered thoroughly upright and capable. "I have always been fond of the West African proverb, 'Speak softly and carry a big stick. You will go far,'" Roosevelt exultantly told a friend. "If I had not carried the big stick, the organization would not have gotten behind me." At the same time, he pointed out, had he yelled and blustered, he would not have been able to muster 10 votes in the Senate for Hendricks' nomination. Indeed, following the righteous recommendations of the Evening Post would have ensured Payne's retention and facilitated a very imposing triumph for rascality. The outcome of the Payne contest is a complete vindication of the governor's way of accomplishing results, Steffens' commercial advertiser declared. Could the governor have accomplished any more than he has if he had declared open war on the organization? The Evening Post remained dissatisfied. Although Hendricks' appointment promised an honest administration of the insurance department, the Post declared, the governor should have selected his own man without consulting the organization, and he could thus have dealt the Republican machine such a blow as it has never suffered. The moral courage of the governor at Albany was not equal to the physical courage of the colonel before Santiago. Roosevelt's stormy relationship with Platt troubled him far less than the perpetual hail of invective from fellow reformers. Could they assail such a man more viciously and persistently than they have assailed him? The commercial advertiser queried in his defense. Are they not making it possible for the politicians to say, we gave the reformers a governor who secured reforms, and who would not do what we wished him to do? They fell upon him because he did not get reforms in their way, not because he did not get reforms. Why not simply choose one of our own machine men from here on in? They surely won't attack him more fiercely than they have Roosevelt. Even as he excoriated the dogs of the Evening Post for their attacks, Roosevelt preserved his friendship with the Post's longtime editorial writer, John Buckland Bishop. I value you too much to go into recrimination, he wrote to Bishop in the wake of another derogatory Post editorial. Now, I have a proposal to make. Wouldn't you like to come up here and meet some of the wild beasts? During his weekends in New York, Roosevelt encouraged Bishop to visit Bammy's Madison Avenue townhouse so they could air their disagreements. I will explain to you the merits of the police bill, if it passes, he suggested, and you shall explain to me its demerits, if it fails. Their lively correspondence mollified rancor that might have hardened into lasting hostility. After being quoted that he was uncertain which he regarded with the most unaffected dread, the machine politician or the fool reformer, Roosevelt hastily assured Bishop that he was emphatically not one of the fool reformers. In late 1899, after 16 years at the post, Bishop made the wrenching decision to leave the newspaper. His standing at the paper had deteriorated after he declined to follow positive orders to suppress the truth concerning Roosevelt's accomplishments. The policy of the Evening Post, he was informed, is to break down Roosevelt. Consequently, Roosevelt was thrilled when Bishop joined Steffens at the Commercial Advertiser. "You are about 14 different kinds of a Trump," Roosevelt told him. "I thank heaven for the Advertiser continually." With both Bishop and Steffens writing for the well-regarded paper, Roosevelt now had two advocates who might promote vital support among the practical reformers. In the months that followed, the friendship between Bishop and Roosevelt deepened. Roosevelt sought Bishop's advice on speeches, appointments, and legislation. He invited him to stay overnight in the governor's mansion, met with him regularly over meals in Manhattan, and exchanged letters two or three times a week. "Good Lord, what an interesting correspondence we have had at times," Roosevelt remarked. Their friendship remained strong, even when Bishop publicly disagreed with Roosevelt and told his readers why. "I need not tell you that no criticism of yours can alter in the least my affectionate regard for you," Roosevelt assured Bishop. "You have shown yourself a friend indeed. And above all, when you differ, I know you differ because you honestly think you must." Roosevelt's ability to countenance criticism in the interest of friendship also marked his relationship with the humorist Finley Peter Dunne. Dunne's weekly columns in the Chicago Herald, featuring his adopted persona, the irreverent Irish bartender Martin Dooley, placed him among the nation's most popular and influential literary figures. Dunne later recalled that his first acquaintance with Colonel Roosevelt grew, strangely enough, out of an article that was by no means friendly to him. In the fall of 1899, a copy of The Rough Riders, Roosevelt's wartime memoir, came across Dunne's desk. Mr. Dooley's book review in Harper's Weekly mocked Roosevelt's propensity for placing himself at the center of all the action. "'Tis the biography of a hero by one who knows. Tis the dare and exploits of a brave man be an actual eyewitness," Mr. Dooley observes. "If I was him, I'd call the book Alone in Cubia." 3 days after the satirical assessment amused readers across the country, Roosevelt wrote to Dunne, "I regret to state that my family and intimate friends are delighted with your review of my book. Now, I think you owe me one, and I shall exact that when you next come east you pay me a visit. I have long wanted the chance of making your acquaintance." "I shall be very happy to call on you the next time I go to New York," Dunne replied. "At the same time, the way you took Mr. Dooley is a little discouraging. The number of persons who are worthwhile firing at is so small that, as a matter of business, I must regret the loss of one of them. Still, if in losing a target I have, perhaps, gained a friend, I am in after all." The humorist never had to make the choice he feared. He continued to lampoon the nation's premier target without losing Roosevelt's friendship. "I never knew a man with a keener humor, or one who could take a joke on himself with better grace," Dunne recalled. For years, Roosevelt told and retold the story of meeting a charming young lady at a reception. "Oh, Governor," she said, "I've read everything you ever wrote." "Really? What book did you like best?" "Why, that one, you know, Alone in Cuba." In June of 1900, as Roosevelt's first term as governor began to wind down, Lincoln Steffens wrote a lengthy political analysis for McClure's. He described Roosevelt's tenure as an experiment, a test to determine whether a leader could serve both the party machine and the good of the state, whether he could simultaneously maintain his ideals and get things done. Steffens vividly depicted the fights over the insurance commissioner and the franchise tax, both of which ended in Roosevelt victories. It remained unclear, however, if the Roosevelt experiment itself would succeed. "Despite an ostensible truce between the governor and Boss Platt," wrote Steffens, "the organization doesn't like Mr. Roosevelt as governor, Neither does Lou Payne, neither do the corporations. The corporations cannot come out openly to fight him. They have simply served notice on the organization that if he is renominated, they will not contribute to campaign funds. Publicly to deny the popular governor a second term, however, would cast the organization in a starkly negative light. The obvious solution, Steffens predicted, would be to promote Roosevelt to the most dignified and harmless position in the gift of his country, the vice presidency. Then everybody could say, "We told you so," for both the theorists and the politicians have said that it is impossible in practical politics to be honest and successful, too. This astute piece, together with several of Steffens' previous articles on Roosevelt, initially attracted Sam McClure's attention. "Your TR article is a Jim Dandy," McClure told Steffens, resolving then and there to bring him from the commercial advertiser to his own publication. "I could read a whole magazine of this kind of material. It is a rattling good article." Roosevelt first became aware of Platt's unwelcome solution in late January of 1900, when three high-ranking representatives from the Republican National Committee came to Albany. They cautioned that he would be tempting Providence to try for two terms as governor, emphasizing the near certainty that he would hopelessly lower his standings with either the independents or the party men before a second term was out. Only great luck, they claimed, had enabled him to get by thus far without cutting his own throat. On the other hand, the vice presidential nomination was a fait accompli if he decided within the next few weeks. Disconcerted by the drift of the conversation, Roosevelt informed the committee men that he had absolutely no interest in the position. "The vice presidency," he told Platt the next day, "is not an office in which a man who is still vigorous and not past middle life has much chance of doing anything. As you know, I am of an active nature." He had thoroughly enjoyed being governor and strongly desired a second term. "As governor," Roosevelt added, "I could achieve something, but as vice president, I should achieve nothing." Cabot Lodge questioned Roosevelt's rationale, concurring with the committee men that his friend was tempting Providence by remaining in New York. He would be wiser to accept the political haven of the vice presidency, the true stepping stone either toward the presidency or the governor generalship of the Philippines. Roosevelt conceded that in New York, with the Republican Party shading on the one hand into corrupt politicians and on the other hand into a group of impracticables, the task of getting results is one of incredible difficulty, and the danger of being wrecked very great. Nevertheless, this very challenge rendered the work both important and absorbing. He could not bear to be a mere figurehead, with no other task than presiding over the Senate. "I should be in a cold shiver of rage at inability to answer hounds like Pettigrew and the scarcely more admirable Mason and Hale." Moreover, he confided to Lodge, "The money question is a serious one with me. As governor, he made $10,000 a year and was comparatively well paid, having not only a salary but a house which is practically kept up all winter. Between the remnant of his inheritance and the few expenses in Albany, he had been able to save money for the first time in years. For Edith, perpetually worried about family finances, this stability was a great comfort, especially since their older children would soon start private school. The vice president's salary was $2,000 less, and no house was provided. Furthermore, the Roosevelts would be expected to entertain as lavishly as their predecessors, men frequently selected based on their resources and affinity for the social side of the office. Even if his family lived simply," Roosevelt concluded, "the position would be a serious drain for him, causing both him and his wife continual anxiety." In addition, Roosevelt did not perceive the vice presidency as a likely avenue to the White House. A student of history, he was well aware that over 60 years had passed since a sitting vice president had been elected to the presidency. His chances in 1904 would be far better if he served as governor of the most populous state in the Union than if he languished in oblivion as vice president. Despite these objections, Roosevelt reasoned, if the vice presidency led to the governor generalship of the Philippines, then the question would be entirely altered. That post was the one he desired above all others, even a second gubernatorial term. From the moment the United States acquired the islands as a provision of the treaty ending the Spanish-American War, Roosevelt had coveted the job of creating a new government in a Philippines free of Spanish tyranny. The benign, vigorously paternal leadership he envisioned would prove to the islanders that his country intended not merely to treat them well, but to give them a constantly increasing measure of self-government until they could stand alone as a nation. During the acrimonious Senate debate over ratification of the peace treaty, Roosevelt had expressed nothing but contempt for anti-imperialists, who justly argued that acquisition of the Philippines would signal a violent departure from the established traditions and principles of our republic. "They are little better than traitors," Roosevelt flatly told Lodge, while his public rhetoric made the alternatives stridently clear. "We shall be branded with the steel of clinging shame if we leave the Philippines to fall into a welter of bloody anarchy," he proclaimed, "instead of taking hold of them and governing them with righteousness and justice, in the interests of their own people even more than in the interests of ours." Serving as the civilian leader on the islands would not be pleasant, Roosevelt told Maria Storer, "for I should have to cut myself off from my family, who would surely not relocate to the war-torn Philippines." The task, however, he considered emphatically worth doing, and he was increasingly convinced that the chief pleasure really worth having for any man is the doing well of some work that ought to be done. Moreover, Roosevelt's evolving doctrine of sacrifice and satisfaction applied to nations as well as individuals. In a widely quoted speech delivered in Chicago in April of 1900, he insisted that if we shrink from the hard contests where men must win at hazard of their lives and at risk of all they hold dear, then the bolder and stronger peoples will pass us by and win for themselves the domination of the world. It is only through strife, through hard and dangerous endeavor, that we shall ultimately win the goal of true national greatness. McKinley had assured Lodge that Roosevelt was the ideal man to be the first pioneer governor, but explained that the appointment would not be made until American troops stationed in the Philippines suppressed the native uprising that had followed the treaty. Known as the Philippine Insurrection, that conflict had erupted when the Filipinos learned, after decades of fighting for independence, that they had been betrayed into exchanging the rule of Spain for American occupation. With 35,000 additional troops authorized by Congress, Roosevelt projected that within 2 years the rebellion would be crushed, a necessary step before the United States could execute its avowedly beneficent intentions. As governor of New York, he would be free to instantly resign and assume the pioneering post, whereas he would be irreversibly planted in the vice presidency for 4 years. Though he hated to counter Lodge's judgment on a matter of such importance, Roosevelt decided to declare decisively that he did not want the vice presidency. Lodge reluctantly accepted Roosevelt's decision, but warned that if he attended the Republican convention in June, continued refusal in the face of popular clamor for his nomination would damage his future prospects. "There are lots of good men who are strongly for you now who will not like it," Lodge cautioned. Though Roosevelt acknowledged his friend's admonitions, he was constitutionally incapable of foregoing involvement. He allowed himself to be chosen as one of four delegates at large from New York, and made plans to bring Edith, his sister Corinne, and her husband Douglas to Philadelphia. 3 weeks before the convention opened, Judge Alton Brooks Parker was a guest of the Roosevelts at the governor's mansion. Over dinner, Edith expressed her excitement over her first national convention. "You will have the most wonderful time of your life," Judge Parker promised. "You will see almost all the Republican senators and members of Congress, many of them with brilliant careers in the public service. And you will see your handsome husband come in, and bedlam will at once break loose, and he will receive such a demonstration of applause from the thousands of delegates and guests as no one else will receive. Then, some 2 or 3 days later, you will see your husband unanimously nominated for the office of vice president." "You disagreeable thing," Edith interrupted. "I don't want to see him nominated for the vice presidency." Parker, who regarded Edith highly, instantly regretted his words when he saw how very anxious she was that his prophecy should not come true. For Edith, the vice presidency foretold only burdensome expenses and a stilted social life filled with formal receptions and idle chatter. Most importantly, she and Theodore had more time together in the gubernatorial mansion than they had in years. She was by his side when he made his rounds to local fairs and pioneer picnics. "I really think she enjoyed it as much as I did," Roosevelt proudly reported to Lodge after an 8-day stretch of the county fair business. Sagamore Hill beckoned when the legislature adjourned in summer and was close enough to Albany to provide a romantic escape, even in the fall. Judge Parker joined the Roosevelts at another dinner party a few days after his disconcerting conversation with Edith. "You gave my wife a bad quarter of an hour the other night," Roosevelt told him. "Did you mean all you said to her?" Parker replied that he meant every word, adding that Roosevelt's only possibility of evading the vice presidential nod was to avoid Philadelphia altogether and deliver elsewhere a categorical refusal of the nomination. By the time the convention opened in late June, Roosevelt was no longer certain how to proceed. As he pondered his future, his doubts grew. Even if he secured the gubernatorial nomination for a second term, there was at least an even chance that he would be beaten. Even if he did win, he could easily come a cropper with any subsequent misstep that would signal, in all probability, the end of any outside ambition. Nevertheless, he continued to prefer the hazardous pursuit of a second term to being buried alive in the vice presidency. The moment Roosevelt arrived in Philadelphia, the stampede for his nomination began, just as Cabot Lodge and Judge Parker had predicted. Entering the crowded lobby of the Hotel Walton around 6 p.m., he was met by vociferous applause and thunderous cries of "Teddy, Teddy, Teddy." When the raucous crowd launched into a chorus of "There'll be a hot time in the old town tonight," journalists noted, Roosevelt blushed, doffed his hat, and bowed his acknowledgments as he recognized the tune played after his charge up San Juan Hill. He had scarcely finished breakfast the following morning, the New York Tribune reported, when he had reason to suspect that something of importance affecting his political fortunes had happened in the course of the night. One state delegation after another invaded his room, announcing that he was their unanimous choice for vice president. Throughout the western states, where Roosevelt was regarded as one of their own, the enthusiasm was overwhelming. Corinne was with her brother when the Kansas delegation arrived. "Round and round the room they went," she recalled, chanting, "We want Teddy, we want Teddy, we want Teddy," to the accompaniment of fife, drum, and bugle. Similar demonstrations of support came from California, Colorado, the Dakotas, and Nevada. The bosses of the eastern states followed suit. To a man, they pledged the full support of their delegations. Platt had done his work well. The only resistance had come from the Conservative Party chairman, Ohio's Mark Hanna. "Don't you realize," Hanna famously objected, "that there's only one life between this madman and the White House?" In the end, even Hanna conceded that Roosevelt would add more strength to the ticket than any other candidate. "There is not a man, woman, or child in the hotels of Quakertown tonight," the Washington Times reported, "who does not believe that T.R. is to be nominated as President McKinley's running mate." "These fellows have placed me in an awful position," Roosevelt complained. "If I refused it, people will say that Roosevelt has a big head and thinks he is too much of a man to be vice president." Lodge had little patience with Roosevelt's continued reluctance. "If you decline the nomination," he informed his friend, "you had better take a razor and cut your throat." Roosevelt eventually resigned himself to the inevitable nomination. The next morning, the sun shone brightly for the first time in several days as the formal proceedings began. When the chair recognized Roosevelt to second McKinley's nomination, the magic of his personality sent the multitude into convulsions of enthusiasm. From the gallery, Edith watched her husband stride toward the platform amidst the sea of waving, cheering humanity. The jubilation continued while Roosevelt commanded the stage. He made no acknowledgments, no salutations to the plaudits, but, like a hero receiving his due, calmly awaited the subsidence of the tumult. His expression relaxed only once, the New York Tribune correspondent remarked, when he caught a glimpse of his wife in the gallery and waved his hand to her. At last, with his uplifted hand, the demonstration subsided. Finally, Roosevelt addressed the adoring crowd. "We stand on the threshold of a new century, big with the fate of mighty nations," he proclaimed. "We face the coming years high of heart and resolute of faith, that to our people is given the right to win such honor and renown as has never yet been vouchsafed to the nations of mankind." It was not a speech, observed one reporter, of rounded periods, such as Senator Lodge could deliver, nor did it have the fervor or the rich metaphor of the Walcotts and Dollivers. Nevertheless, no other speech proved so effective, none so full of character, and none which found so responsive an audience. It carried everything before it, and old campaigners sighed that such energy was beyond them. Once the frenzy of the convention had waned, however, Roosevelt admitted to a friend that he felt a little melancholy. While he should be a conceited fool not to appreciate such resounding support, the thought of 4 years in the restrictive office of the vice presidency remained abhorrent. His friends were in despair, Jacob Riis wrote. His enemies triumphed. At last, they had him where they wanted him. His family shared Roosevelt's aversion to the prospect. "Oh, how I hate this vice presidency," Corinne told Fanny Parsons. "Poor Edith feels it tremendously, too." Indeed, Edith admitted to Emily that she had hoped to the last moment that some other candidate would be settled upon. Her only comfort was the prospect that her husband might get the rest that he sadly needs, and for the next 4 years he will have an easy time. While Theodore Roosevelt tried to reconcile himself to the unhappy combination of events resulting in the vice presidential nomination, William Howard Taft would embark on the most gratifying period of his long public career. In late January of 1900, a telegraph boy knocked on the door of the consultation room at the Circuit Court in Cincinnati. He handed Judge Taft a telegram, summoning him to the White House for important business with President McKinley. "What do you suppose that means?" he excitedly asked Nellie that evening. She had no answer. Had there been an opening on the Supreme Court, the summons might have foretold his long-desired appointment to the bench, but no vacancy then existed. Secretary of War Elihu Root and Navy Secretary Long had joined McKinley in the Oval Office when the President informed Taft that he intended to appoint him to a new Philippines commission, charged with formulating a civilian code for governance. "He might as well have told me," Taft remembered, "that he wanted me to take a flying machine." Taft protested that he was not the right man for the task. He was emphatically not an expansionist and had been strongly opposed to taking the Philippines, believing the United States should not take on a responsibility contrary to our traditions and at a time when we had quite enough to do at home. "Such objections were beside the question," McKinley countered. "Now that the Philippines had fallen to us, it behooved the United States to govern them until such time as their people had learned the difficult art of governing themselves." Taft agreed that once the islands were occupied, we were under the most sacred duty to give them a good form of government, but insisted he was not the man best equipped for that important responsibility. He did not speak Spanish, which would hamper easy relationships with the Filipino people. Furthermore, he was loath to relinquish his long-cherished lifetime appointment as a judge. "Well," said McKinley, "all I can say to you is that if you give up this judicial office at my request, you shall not suffer. If I last and the opportunity comes, I shall appoint you." Long confirmed that the president was speaking of a place on the Supreme Court. "Yes," McKinley assured him, "if I'm here, you'll be here." War Secretary Root offered the decisive argument. "You have had a very fortunate career," he told Taft. "You are at the parting of the ways. Will you take the easier course, the way of least resistance, or will you take the more courageous course, and, risking much, achieve much?" Taft asked for a week to ponder the matter with his wife and brothers. On the overnight train heading back to Cincinnati, Taft didn't sleep a wink. Root's words about courage frequented his thoughts, and the president's implied promise of a Supreme Court appointment beckoned powerfully. Despite his mounting excitement, Taft was certain that the long distance and the atrocious climate of Manila would not prove a happy prospect for Nellie. Unlike Roosevelt, he could not imagine a protracted absence from his family. By the time he reached home, his countenance was so grave that Nellie thought he must be facing impeachment. Will explained the president's proposal to his wife, doubtful she would consider joining him.